I'm Jim Falzerano, and this is Guardian Daily for Friday, the 29th of May. Coming up in today's podcast, Labour MPs are lining up for ermine robes.
I've discovered that a minimum of 52 sitting Labour MPs put their names on a list as and when Labour loses office, so that they'll go straight from the green benches of the Commons to the red benches of the Lords.
And what does a failed state look like? The faces of Somalia will tell you.
There is this look on the faces of people that they look into your face and they see someone who's going to die in the next minute or two, because anyone can kill you so easily.
Plus, Rowan Williams on the return to faith. But first, a look at the headlines in today's papers with Bill Overton.
Two more MPs are to lose their seats over their role in the ongoing expenses scandal. Tory Julie Kirkbride and Labour's Margaret Moran have announced their intention to stand down at the next election. Another Tory MP, Christopher Fraser, says he intends to quit. Some MPs, in an effort to save their political careers, have applied to sit in the House of Lords after the next general election. 52 MPs have formally approached Downing Street to be given places in the upper house. President Obama's challenged Israel to stop settlement construction in the West Bank on the same day the Israelis rejected the demand. The president pushed Palestinians for progress too, deepening his personal involvement. He said after meeting Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas at the White House, both sides must meet the obligations that they've already committed to, which is an element of the peace effort that has proved elusive for years. Six convicted child rapists avoided jail in a single year. Ministry of Justice statistics show two paedophiles were given suspended sentences for sex attacks on children under 13. Four other dangerous sex attackers were given community sentences. That means one in 12 of all child rapists over 21 wasn't given an immediate custodial sentence that year. The Doctor Who actor David Tennant is to reprise his well-received stage portrayal as Hamlet for television. He'll perform in the BBC Two production with the main cast members of the recent Royal Shakespeare Company version, including Star Trek actor Patrick Stewart. And now for a look at today's newspapers. The names and faces of shamed MPs, both Tory and Labour, fill the front pages of three papers. The Daily Telegraph has new revelations about Tory grandee Bill Cash, who claimed more than £15,000 to pay rent on his daughter's London flat. The golden goodbye that many departing MPs will be paid features on the front of the Daily Mail and The Independent. The fate of General Motors and its bankruptcy claim on the Financial Times, as well as news that fashion house Christian Lacroix is on the brink of collapse. The Times reveals what it calls the hidden massacre in Sri Lanka, with a photograph of an alleged mass grave, and claims that tens of thousands of civilians were killed in fighting between government forces and Tamil rebels. And finally, Susan Boyle's future lies in balance, according to The Sun. The Britain's Got Talent star's outburst at a policeman yesterday prompted television bosses to whisk her away from the limelight amid fears that the attention is going to her head. Those are the headlines. As always, there's more news updated throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
More than 50 Labour MPs have asked to join the House of Lords after the next general election. I asked Guardian columnist Martin Kettle what this tells us about Labour's political prospects and its principles.
I've discovered that a minimum of 52 sitting Labour MPs, backbench MPs for the most part, have solicited Gordon Brown to put their names on a list of MPs as and when Labour loses office, so that they'll go straight from the green benches of the Commons to the red benches of the Lords, and they'll never leave Westminster again.
So what does this tell us about Labour's prospects? I mean, is this a sort of a tacit admission of defeat?
Well, I think it certainly is. Two things, really. First of all, yes, it just shows that they think the game's up, that they're planning for after the defeat, and although in some cases, some of these MPs, I think, are not announcing that they're retiring. They're going to contest the next election, but they're planning for the defeat that they won't admit to. But the second thing is clearly that it shows how ambivalent, to put it mildly, the Labour benches in the Commons are about major reform of the House of Lords, because the self-interest and what might be the public interest are very much in conflict here.
Given the degree of public anger that exists right now over MPs' expenses and a general dissatisfaction with government, this certainly can't improve the public's perception of their MPs. What is the likely reaction?
I think the reaction to my story is very likely to be bad for the Labour Party, because, you know, Labour would love to be seen as the party of reform. All parties are trying to be the party of reform and respond to the public mood. But with so many Labour MPs jostling to get into an unreformed House of Lords as a sort of meal ticket for life, I mean, that is a real that's a real turnoff for the voters. It just shows they say one thing in public and do another thing in private. Having said that, I do want to stress that not all of these 52 Labour MPs will end up in the House of Lords. They're all banging on Gordon Brown's door asking for a favour from him. Depending on what happens at the next general election, you know, there are quite likely to be far more Labour MPs or Labour supporters wanting a billet in the House of Lords than Brown is able to offer them.
So who decides?
Well, there is a tradition that after a general election, there is what's called a dissolution honours list. That could mean that Labour will give places in the Lords to a number of for defeated MPs. There will also be some discussion with the other parties about a list of so-called working peers, which will be a list comprised of nominees from all the parties. But what these MPs currently sitting are trying to do is to book their ticket on that list. Now, I think there are going to be a lot of disappointed people.
Might this not have an unintended consequence, that if the public perceives the House of Lords as merely a dumping ground for political cronies, that the movement or the impetus for reform might grow even stronger?
I think that is happening anyway. I mean, remember what we've just witnessed in the last few weeks, the suspension, unprecedented in history, of two members of the House of Lords for corruption, two others having to apologise to the Lords in open session. Again, that's not at all common. There's a mythology about the House of Lords that it's full of great independence and great learning and great ability. Of course, there are people of independence, learning and ability in the Lords. I'm not disputing that. But increasingly, membership of the House of Lords is about being there to vote for the government, just as it is in the Commons. There are a lot of people going, in all parties, but particularly in Labour, I think, from being lobby fodder in the Commons to being lobby fodder in the Lords.
Martin Kettle. And there's more on that story at guardian.co.uk/politics. Julie Kirkbride thought she could weather the storm over her involvement in the MP expenses scandal, but she didn't count on the resolve of constituent Louise Marnell of the Julie Must Go campaign. We caught up with Marnell in the constituency of Bromsgrove after the Tory MP decided to stand down.
Well, we're happy, we're really happy, you know, that she's listened to the people and she's made the right decision at the end of the day.
Now, before this controversy, was there any indication that anything was wrong? Did you have any problems with the MP? Was there any clue that this was going on?
I think perhaps, I mean, I haven't really taken much notice of politics, you know, up until this expenses scandal. But from what a lot of the public has told me, there was suspicions about 2 years ago when she was asked on a radio show, apparently, and put the phone down. So, but I mean, that's, I didn't hear that personally myself, so I can't.
Just generally speaking, were you pleased with her as an MP? Was she known for good constituency service?
People I've spoken to have said basically, no, it was about getting her, you know, the Sinner face in the paper, but not much else. But, I mean, as I say, I've not really followed her on a personal basis, so I can't really comment on that.
Sure. What was the tipping point here? Was it the fact that you found out that she claimed the £50,000, or was it that she insisted in defending herself and basically resisting calls to go?
I think it was the whole expenses scandal from the beginning, and the fact that, you know, it was like the people were saying, you know, we really want you to step down. We were just getting stonewalled and we were getting ignored, you know, and it just made people angrier and angrier, I think.
Sure. One more question. Is there a lesson here for other MPs who are involved in this scandal?
Well, I think there is. I think all MPs need to look at themselves and realise that, yeah, we will stand up and say something, and they can't sort of like dismiss this or get away with it. Excuses aren't enough. People are actually wanting action, and this is something that I feel that all party leaders should be aware of as well.
Louise Marnell. Still to come, unjust rewards for bankers and for politicians.
People have had a chance to look into the living rooms of those who govern them, their MPs, and they don't like what they see.
Guardian reporter Gaith Abdul-Ahad has seen chaos and civil war in his native Iraq, in Afghanistan, and elsewhere. But he has never seen anything like what he experienced in Mogadishu. I asked him about the many failures of Somalia.
I come from Iraq, and I grew up in Baghdad, and I've been to Afghanistan, I've been to most of the Middle East, and I always presume that I have an experience in civil wars and in failed states and all these things. But until I arrived in Mogadishu, I don't think I've seen a failed state or a civil war in that sense, that there is no civil society, there is no law and order. There is no institution, there are no governments, the law falls into the hands of the people. In that sense, the ultimate fragmentation of a society, then every single person in Mogadishu is the law in himself. So there is nothing that can protect a human being. There is this look on the faces of people that they look into your face and they see someone who's going to die in the next minute or two, because anyone can kill you so easily. In that sense, it was very scary. It was the ultimate civil war situation I've been. But also, because there is no government, because it's a failed state, so everything becomes the utopia of free market in a way. If you're a businessman and you want to do business, there are no rules, no regulations, no government to impose taxes. All what you need is your bunch of armed guards, your private militia, and then you can do business.
To the average person in Mogadishu, do they have any understanding of that there is a government? Is there any indication at all that there is someone who at least might possibly be in charge?
When I met the president, Sheikh Sharif Ahmed, he lives in a compound guarded by AU, African Union troops. And when I met him, he controlled almost 50% of Mogadishu. When I left Mogadishu a few days later, his authority shrunk to probably one-third of the city. He tells you, when I met him, he tells me that I have the most difficult job in the world. Obama is a president of the United States, but Obama has institutions, has a Congress, has ministries, has people to work with him. A president of Somalia is basically the most hopeless job in the world that you can do. The Islamists, who were all one united front when they fought the Ethiopians and kicked the Ethiopians out, the moment the Ethiopians left and the moment that the Islamists themselves, the Islamic courts, took power, they themselves split amongst different lines between conservatives and moderates, whatever you want to call the lines. It's the ultimate, curse of Somalia, that whenever a group of people take power, they immediately split among some hidden line and they start fighting themselves. So when in the first few days of my stay, people were telling me, yes, we're very happy, it's very good, finally there is a sort of government that kind of came to power. Now, when I talk to the people in Mogadishu over the phone or talk to some of my friends, it's all back into the same civil war situation when the warlords were fighting, only now it's not warlords, they are the Islamists.
In your time there, did you see anyone, talk to anyone who had hope?
That's a very, very, very sad question, because I went into a shop of an old man who used to, be kind of like sort of a lawyer or a clerk in his own neighborhood. The street used to be called Rome Street. And in that street, this man is still living in some nostalgia to the time when Mogadishu was a beautiful city, when the wall of his shop is filled with pictures and paper clippings 20 years old from newspapers, showing Mogadishu, showing the streets, showing cars, traffic lights. And he was pointing at the street and he was saying, look, there is no fighting now in the street and people are out, people are working, people are going to the market. I mean, if you look into that street that he's pointing at and saying it's a happy time, it's one of the worst, you know, cliches of kind of destroyed cities. It's like the worst, I don't know, nightmare of a Hollywood, movie set of a destroyed city. But still, for the old man, when there are no bullets whizzing in the air, that's hope, that's a good thing, that's a good sign. But in reality, I think that's the look that you see on the faces of the people in Somalia, which is, you know, utter kind of wretchedness, and it's very, very, very sad and destroyed place.
Gaith Abdul-Ahad. And there's more on that story at guardian.co.uk/world. Also from the web, the hidden reserves of oil in the Arctic pose difficult questions for global politics and the environment. Read Alok Jha's investigation at guardian.co.uk/environment. Can Manchester United recover from their disappointment in Rome? Read all the build-up to Saturday's FA Cup final at guardian.co.uk/football. And former Home Secretary David Blunkett argues that politics must change, not just the makeup of Parliament. Have your say at guardian.co.uk/comment is free. When Guardian columnist Polly Toynbee and co-author David Walker wrote their book Unjust Rewards, Greed and Inequality in Britain Today last year, they could not have imagined the financial implosion and the political grasping that have led to so much public anger. I asked them to update their tale of greed and denial.
Unbeknownst to us, we talked to them on the very cusp of the implosion. I mean, we didn't know at the time that within a matter almost of weeks of the structured conversations we had with top bankers and lawyers for our book, that the world, the floors beneath them would begin collapsing. We haven't been able to replicate the structured conversation we had with them, but we have had a number of one-to-ones and more informal conversations. And I have to say, rather like MPs, they are in denial. They do not accept that they are responsible for the collapse of capitalism, the collapse of the financial sector. They do not see the kind of connection which seems to us, and I think to a lot of British people, to be patently obvious, that their high rewards were entirely unjustified by their performance, and they ought to accept responsibility and also accept a considerable downsizing of the financial packages which have become common. So what you find are people who say two things. One, we're still worth it, even though the world's collapsing around us. And second, for God's sake, don't do anything to us by way of regulation or taxation, because we are still the people on whom the British economy's potential growth depends. And don't do anything to London, City of London, because we're all going to decamp to Zurich or Frankfurt or New York or wherever, even though we all know that the opportunities available for British bankers or British-based bankers in other financial sectors are incredibly small. So the odd thing of the moment is a sense of people actually refusing to accept, even in rhetoric, even in private.
Now, Polly, we're talking here about the sirs and lords of the financial realm, but let's talk a little bit about the sirs and lords of the political realm. And give me a sense of how you think these two things might be related.
I think there is a connection. What's happened by accident, that was bound to happen sooner or later, is that people have had a chance to look into the living rooms of those who govern them, their MPs, and they don't like what they see. They see a standard of living which seems to them exorbitant. The idea that you could claim $100,000 just in expenses. You see MPs who seem to have lost touch with what's ordinary. They say, we're not paid very much, we're paid $64,000. Well, when $24,000 is the median, half the population earn less than that, they're paid nearly three times what half the population would regard as fine. And I think there's been a kind of coming together, although it hasn't really got a political expression. It comes out as just revolutionary fury, tear them down, throw rotten eggs at them. There hasn't been a rhetoric or a politics to channel that anger into anything more constructive, as to say, well, what's wrong with a society that's as unequal as this? What's wrong with a society where, 10% at the top, only 10% earn more than 40,000? seem to live such different lives, in particular the top five and the top 1%, to the rest of them, that the two ends of society have lost touch with each other, which is exactly what our book is about.
Is this something that you think will blow over, or is this something that is going to change the culture of deference that MPs and bankers have benefited from for so long?
I'm not sure there has been much deference for politicians. They've always come at the bottom of the ranks of esteem. They used to come just a little bit above journalists, debt collectors, and estate agents. They've now sunk below even those. So I think there's always been a healthy scepticism about politicians. Nevertheless, something has broken now in quite a fundamental way, and nobody knows how to put it back together again. Are we going to throw them all out, anybody who claimed any expenses? There seems at the moment to be no logical system for deciding how many step too far over the line. Where is the line? It seems to be random where the searchlight falls and where perhaps the press particularly pulls down some one particular MP, often because they've got something rather colourful, like a duck island.
Yeah, I mean, let's not get carried away. I mean, no direct relationship exists between the people and their government that isn't mediated, to use a cliche, I'm afraid, by newspapers, by broadcasters. And we have been witnessing the pillorying of MPs, not by the people, but by a right-of-centre newspaper, which may or may not have an agenda to do with big party politics behind it. So I think one of the questions to ask is, could the people establish any kind of direct relationship with their governors outwith the massaging, the controlling, which to some extent goes on by newspapers, including maybe this one?
But the sadness is that there is nobody channeling this into a sensible politics. It's become an anti-politics movement. Anti-politicians and anti-politics, anti-political ideas. There is nobody, one wants somebody with clean hands to step forward and say, right, we'll clean all this up. Now let's look underneath this at what's really making people angry. Actually, it is that Britain is one of the most unequal countries. And it bubbles underneath the surface. But if nobody ever articulates it, it doesn't really enter into the bloodstream of the country in the way that it all. If this is a revolutionary moment, there doesn't seem to be anybody using revolutionary language, which perhaps we should be.
Polly Toynbee and David Walker. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, thinks people are turning back to religion as the economy crashes and secular society fails to come up with adequate solutions. He spoke to The Guardian's Madeleine Bunting at the Hay Festival.
Culturally speaking, it is very interesting that after the great wave of anti-religious literature in the last couple of years, there is a certain sense that maybe that's not quite a spent force, but that other things are happening and that deeper dimensions are opening up.
And do you find that sort of cause for optimism? Do you think that interesting things could emerge in that conversation?
I'm sure interesting things will emerge. It doesn't necessarily translate, of course, into people flocking back into the churches. That doesn't happen quickly because the churches themselves have their own issues which need a lot of tackling. People aren't simply going to start going to matins again. But the beginning of some kind of, I don't know, reclaiming of the cultural territory from the Christian point of view lies in conversations that take Christianity seriously enough to engage.
I wonder whether the interest is primarily sociological, if you like, or anthropological, in the sense of trying to understand what makes societies hold together, rather than some sort of spiritual quest.
I think it's probably both, isn't it? And certainly at the moment, with all the questions we're asking about what cohesiveness can societies have, what do we say when things are, when there's manifestly evidence of things falling apart all around us, it's not entirely surprising if people begin to ask what does make societies cohere. But having asked that, you may well want to ask further, well, where does that come from? What kind of validity has it? What kind of possibility does it give?
I'm very interested by you saying everything is manifestly falling apart. I mean, what you find amongst a lot of people who say, you know, that Christianity always kind of is allied with a certain sort of pessimism, that, you know, there is an argument that, you know, we live with kind of an unprecedented degree of respect for human rights in this country, etc., etc. You know, why do you have to be so miserable about everything?
Well, I don't think I feel miserable. And I don't think it's pessimism. It's just realism. There is a crumbling of some certainties at the moment. Just as in the Victorian age there was a crumbling of religious certainties, so The fundamentalism about the market is weaker than it was. Our sense of what we expect in our political life is much more confused than it was even 6 weeks ago. And I think there is bound then to be a question, where does the unifying ethical perspective come from?
And you think it comes from Christianity?
Obviously, I think it comes from Christianity, which is not to say people don't live admirable lives without the Christian foundation. It's just that when you begin to ask the question, so what's the ground of it? What's the rationale? Then maybe the lack of a secular answer is still a factor in getting Christianity back onto the agenda.
Rowan Williams. You can hear the full interview on Saturday's Haycast. That's our daily podcast from the Hay Festival of Literature. This podcast was produced by Phil Maynard. I'm Jim Falzerano. Thanks for listening.